This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. Well, it has been another long week, but through the fog of the past 10 days, we're getting more firsthand accounts of the Boston Marathon bombings, including a cab driver who says he picked up the Tsarnaev brothers just hours before the blasts.
I asked them if they're going to the marathon. They flipped out. I didn't pick up a heavy backpack out of my bag and hand it to him.
And Jahar Tsarnaev was formally charged this week as thousands gathered to remember MIT police officer Sean Collier. Here's his brother, Rob Rogers.
People have asked me if Sean were here, what would you think? Are you kidding me? He would love this. You got sirens, flashing lights, formations, people saluting.
Thousands of people saluting, in fact. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts politics, things get testy in the latest debate between Senate hopefuls, Democrats Stephen Lynch and Edward Markey.
Just taking a page right out of the Karl Rove Swift Boat playbook. Please don't interrupt me, Steve.
Okay.
I did not interrupt you.
Go ahead.
Please do not interrupt me.
Okay, sorry.
And Carol Johnson announced her resignation as superintendent of Boston Public Schools.
After a long and rewarding career that I am truly proud of, I believe it is time for me to take time to focus more on family, which, of course, always comes first.
So we're going to dive into all of these stories with our Week in Review team. Today, joining us is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of Architecture Boston. Renee, good to see you again.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Also with us is John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the keyboard at the blog Campaign Outsider. John, good to see you as
well. Good to be here.
So let's start off, of course, with all the latest news this week in the marathon bombing story. This morning, we found out that 19-year-old Jahar Tsarnaev has been moved from his hospital bed at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center to a prison hospital near Fort Devens. We're also learning more about the attacks themselves and what might have been, because here's news out of New York City with Mayor Michael Bloomberg when he spoke yesterday.
Last night, we were informed by the FBI that the surviving attacker revealed that New York City was next on their list of targets. He told the FBI, apparently, that he and his brother had intended to drive to New York and designate additional explosives in Times Square. They had built these additional explosives, and we know they had the capacity to carry out the attacks.
That's, again, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City. John, let's start with you. So dribs and drabs of things that Jahar Tsarnaev is allegedly saying from his hospital bed, and still a lot of uncertainty into who knew what. What did the government know? What did it not know? What's your take on where we are so far, 10 days after the bombings?
Well, I think we're in the etch-a-sketch phase of the story. There's all kinds of new information coming out, contradicting old information that we had. It turns out Jahar Tsarnaev did not have a gun, according to the latest reports.
So when he was apprehended in the boat.
When he was apprehended on Friday night in the boat. So he couldn't have been the one who fired first. He couldn't have been the one who fired at all. Mm-hmm. So what happened there? It turned out they didn't rob a 7-Eleven while they were joyriding around. The boat was inside the perimeter, outside the perimeter, hard to know at this point. A lot of conflicting stories. So that's one thing. The other thing is, the great American pastime is not baseball. It's the assigning of blame. And that's the other thing that's going on here. People are trying to pick out the target of who's to blame here. So some are blaming the lack of coordination among law enforcement officials. The Boston Herald has decided to blame Deval Patrick and the welfare system. There are all kinds of targets out there. But that's the other aspect of this.
Well, and in fact, we spoke a little earlier this week to a former member of the CIA who'd spent a good part of his career on terrorism and in terrorism investigations, because apparently Tamerlan Tsarnaev's name had been on one of the country's largest,
two largest.
Yeah, and highly classified terrorist watch lists.
But one has 740,000 names on it, the other has 433,000 names on it. So he was pretty much buried among all the data.
Yeah. So, Renee, what's your thoughts on where we are so far?
Well, I'm just struck, 10 days after the bombing, I'm struck by how personal it still feels. I think that everybody I talk to is 2 degrees of separation, either from a victim or from the the suspects. You know, I know somebody who went to school with the suspect. I also know somebody whose home was, you know, blasted through by the SWAT team on Thursday night or Friday morning, I guess it was. So, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to think clearly about this. And it makes me wonder about the ability to, you know, gather up a decent jury for this eventual prosecution. And I do think that the lawyers for Tsarnaev will be looking for a change of venue.
A change of venue.
Absolutely.
So you think they're going to try and move it out of Massachusetts?
Well, out of Boston.
I think they'll move it out of the U.S. if they can.
They'll probably try to move it to Springfield or something.
Well, given the worldwide nature of this story, I'm not even sure Springfield
is far enough away.
But on that point, let me ask you, I mean, if we rewind to the earlier part of this week when Jahar Tsarnaev was formally charged, there's a lot of questions that people have about the nature of those charges. For example, he was charged with using a weapon of mass destruction. Yeah. I mean, your thoughts on that?
Well, that's what it was. I guess I am not second guessing the charges here, or even the questioning of Tsarnaev without his Miranda rights. I mean, I think these are established in law. I just think it's going to be a very difficult prosecution all the way around. I think the defense team, although I understand from folks who seem to know them, that very good, will have a very difficult time trying to get, you know, trying to avoid the death penalty, for example. It's just, you know, really doesn't get more emotional and difficult than this.
John?
Yeah, I think a weapon of mass destruction is a new definition that the government's introduced. I think fairly recently, as far as I know. It doesn't feel like a weapon of mass destruction unless you're standing next to it.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it does. I think as far as the trial goes, the best thing would be some kind of a plea deal, but I doubt that that's going to happen. To spare the public that the cost and the sort of anxiety and the emotional stress of a trial would be great, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out, kind of ugly affair.
Right. Well, and in fact, I can imagine many people want the trial to happen here where the crime itself was committed.
I mean, I think that, the trial could be a kind of cathartic, experience. It could also be, even more polarizing and more difficult. It's just hard to say at this stage. You know, I think people are all searching for some kind of narrative. I sort of don't like that word. I think it's overused. But, some sort of storyline that makes sense to them to explain all of these events and the motivations of these two young men. Is it a kind of Columbine situation or is it more of an Al-Qaeda situation? You find people trying to, is it a kind of Cain and Abel story, the bad brother and the good brother? I mean, you're hearing a lot of struggle on the part of, I think, every ordinary people to try to make sense of this with some sort of traditional story that they can understand.
Well, and that may be in part because, as John was saying earlier, there's still so much that's uncertain and so much of the story in terms of just sheer facts of what happened when that we still have yet to sort out. But John, let me briefly turn to the ways in which sort of the city as a whole is moving forward from the incidents of 2 weeks ago, because also this week businesses and homeowners along Boylston Street were finally allowed to return there as well. And so we've got some tape here from Ed Borash. He is the owner of Sir Speedy Printing on Boylston Street, and he said he's going to pay his employees for the days that his store was closed down, but that this attack has had a significant impact on his financial well-being.
Our customers have been wonderful, but the bottom line is they've had to go elsewhere to get their jobs done. We had a lot of jobs in-house that we'll probably just have to throw away, and, it's just been really tough.
So, John, I mean, Boylston Street's one of the most active areas of downtown Boston, trying to return to normal. Your thoughts on just that part of the city and how it's moving forward?
I think it's been very difficult for them. A lot of restaurant owners, for instance, people just got up and ran out and left all the food. The FBI came in and said, everybody out. They didn't get to turn off ovens. They didn't get to do anything when they came back. They had mice all over the place. So it was, when you look at it, you say, compared to the physical damage to people, so what? But so what? It has an impact on people. It has an impact on individuals. And a lot of people are in a sort of more difficult straits now because of what happened and because of the way they had to handle it. I don't see the FBI saying, go ahead, go turn off all the coffee pots.
Yeah, take your time. There's just been some bombing.
There wasn't much choice there, but there is a lot of sort of fallout from it.
Renee?
Yeah. I walked through that area and up through the Common and the Boston Garden on Wednesday afternoon, right after they had opened Boylston Street again. And it was, of course, it was a beautiful day, but there was just a massive feeling of relief and release in the part of people there were, you know, and in me, I have to say. I always thought that Boylston Street was kind of a tacky place, and it's not my favorite of Boston's many beautiful streets, but even I felt a really kind of emotional tug toward, you know, Boylston Street and all its chain stores. And I think that, you know, there were millions of languages being spoken and people were happy and, you know, it's just, I don't know how long that'll last, but there just was a true emotional response to that area of the city.
Yeah, chain stores and the Boston Public Library.
That's it.
Well, let's move on, if we can, briefly to Massachusetts politics, because the battle for the Senate seat vacated by now Secretary of State John Kerry is getting rather heated because there are only a few days until the primary for this special election. So on the Democratic side, Congressman Stephen Lynch and Edward Markey met twice this week in debates, and there were fireworks. Here's Stephen Lynch on the attack.
Unlike my colleague, Mr. Markey, I've actually voted for the Department of Homeland Security appropriations bills.
And so here's how Ed Markey shot back.
He's taken a page right out of the Karl Rove Swift Boat playbook. And it's very sad, especially just 1 week after what just happened in Boston and Cambridge and Watertown.
Okay, Renee, so what do you make of the fact that Stephen Lynch seems to be heating things up a few days to go?
I mean, it's what he has to do. He's the challenger, and he has to take some risks. And these are risky attacks, I don't mind saying. You know, I got the robocall, the controversial robocall in my house, you know, sometime this week that played up the bombings that, you know, that said they were from the 99%, you know, an independent PAC, which maybe had the same iron workers in it that supported Lynch.
But Lynch himself has disavowed that
totally
call.
Disavowed it, and it's been taken down. Correct. But, you know, I think he just has to try to shake up the race because it froze 10 days ago, and, you know, it froze with Markey, you know, comfortably ahead. So I think that he needs to do what he can to, you know, to shake things up and put Markey on the defensive. And I think he's succeeding, actually. And, you know, I don't know if it's enough. It's only 3 days from now, the election, or 4 days from now. And the, you know, it's all about turnout. It's going to be, you know, presumably a small turnout mm-hmm. election, although there's really shouldn't be because it's, you know, exciting, really. A good campaign. But, you know, it's all about the turnout, and I don't want to make any predictions, but I do think that, you know, it just may not be enough time.
Well, John, let me ask you about this, because I hear Renee's point in that this is a line of attack that Stephen Lynch may have to take right now, and he's picking particular things like Homeland Security appropriations, which might, you know, resonate with people in this moment in time, given what we've just been through. But on the other hand, being on the attack, being aggressive like that, is that a tone that you think voters are in the mood for right now?
I'm not sure. I mean, there is a whiff of desperation about this, but there's also a whiff of sort of World Wrestling Federation about it, too. And I think that Stephen Lynch has to do this, and he has to take the risk that he's going to look, number one, opportunistic, number two, exploitive in terms of using the Marathon bombing. He used it in one of his most recent ad. He used it in the debate that nobody watched on Monday night. So I think that he has to do this, but I don't think it's going to achieve the objectives that he wants. And I think that if I were him, I would be thinking about my next election, actually. I don't want to give advice to anybody for free.
Except that you will on the radio.
But I think that he doesn't want to do something that would damage him going forward. There have been rumors that he might even jump into the Boston mayoral race. So I think he should be careful, and I think he is trying to be careful. But when you start calling your opponent a liar, that looks a lot stronger than being called a Karl Rovian Swift Boater. And I think that he's really treading on dangerous ground there.
Yeah. Renee, let's briefly talk about the Republican side of things. They were quieter this week than the Democrats were, but they also have just a few days before this primary.
Right. And they also have politicized, or at least the, you know, presumed front runner in this case, you know, Michael Sullivan has politicized the bombings, and you know, really doubling down on his reputation as a tough prosecutor and, you know, law and order guy, you know, calling for Tsarnaev to have his citizenship stripped, his American citizenship taken away, so that they can charge him as an enemy combatant. I mean, you know, that to me, that's really going for a very strong base of the Republican Party. So, I mean, I think we're seeing a little bit of that on their side as well. You know, it's a wide open primary. Independent voters, unenrolled voters who make up the majority in this state can go for a Democratic or a Republican ballot.
Either way, exactly.
And although in a special election, usually you get the hardcore, there are, you know, imponderables about this. And there are some possibilities that we might be surprised on Tuesday.
John, your quick thoughts on the GOP side?
I think that you can to pick them. If you went to the racetrack, you'd bet on all three, just to hedge your bet. I think it's almost impossible to predict because it's been so low profile in many ways, and so it's hard to know what the public is thinking about this race at all. There's been no polling that I've seen. I could be wrong, but I haven't seen any polling, so it's hard to know how this is going to work out. My guess is. I don't have a guess.
Yeah.
Well, this is also a safe way to hedge by not saying what you may not think.
Exactly.
But anyway, one more story before we wrap up today. And given any other circumstances, this would have been a big one, but maybe sort of got pushed off the front page by all the bombing news. And that is the fact that Carol Johnson, superintendent of Boston Public Schools for the past 6+ years or so, has announced her resignation. It'll come at the end of this school year. And it also follows the death of her husband, Matthew, who passed away 6 weeks ago. So, Renee, your thoughts about Carol Johnson's tenure and her resignation from BPS?
Well, you know, I think that she will probably be seen to have had a mixed record. You know, she there were improvements in academic achievement in many of the Boston public schools, but it remains the most difficult of all, you know, city problems. I think that it's a good chance that when a new mayor is elected next year, that he or she would look for their own school superintendent anyway. So she probably wasn't going to be, you know, around after January anyway. So, you know, not a huge surprise given her, you know, personal sorrows that she would look to end at the end of this school year.
Yeah. John?
I think it's almost impossible to head up a big city school system and not have a mixed record. Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine that happening. I think Carol Johnson did some good things. One thing you can say for her is she did not have an educational scandal in terms of grade rigging or test score rigging yet. We hope that doesn't happen. But she did have an administrative scandal, and I think that that hurt her with the Rodney Peterson, the O'Brien School headmaster, who had assaulted his wife, Superintendent Johnson did nothing about it. I think that there were some educational gains made, but there are half of the Boston schools perform in the lowest 20% of schools statewide. So I think there's still a lot of work to do. It's a very tough school system to really raise across the board. I think she made gains in some areas and did not make any gains in some others.
Hmm. Well, we've just got just enough time, barely, for our hubbubs this week. Renee, let's start with you.
My hubbub is about an event tomorrow afternoon down at the Fort Point Channel area. There's a competition going on called the Street Seats Competition. It's difficult to say, where 20 semifinalists are going to be exhibited tomorrow. Designers from 23 countries all over the world proposed designs for new benches for the waterfront area there in the Innovation District. Uh-huh. And so visitors can go try them out and vote for their favorites in a People's Choice competition. I've seen some of these benches, and they are incredibly cool. Although I think getting cool and comfortable in the
exactly.
same bench is kind of a challenge.
That's the tough order. Yeah. Maybe they don't want them to be too comfortable, as people might stay in them a little too long. John Carroll, your hubbub.
My hubbub is the sad passing of the great Murray Pearlstein of Louis Boston, who was a revolutionary in the fashion industry. He's been called an icon, a visionary, a giant, and Joseph Abboud called him the Steve McQueen of our industry.
Am I seeing the inspiration behind your wardrobe here?
No, the inspiration behind my wardrobe is the missus. But he introduced something menswear, which was the ready-made suit that he brought over from Europe, introduced European style to Boston and to America in many ways. He was a complete revolutionary, and everyone in the fashion industry said he changed the course of fashion, men's fashion in particular.
Wow. So passing of a very interesting person here in the region. My hubbub takes us back to the marathon, but just a picture that made my heart soar this week. And it's a picture in a hospital room, and there is a young man sitting in a wheelchair. He's had both his legs amputated, but he is handing a present to another victim of the Boston bombings. The man in the picture is Jeff Bauman, who lost both his legs in the bombing. His picture was also very famously sent around the world because the man in the cowboy hat was the one who saved him. But the woman in the picture is 18-year-old Sydney Corcoran, who she and her mother were also gravely injured. So the fact that Jeff Bauman was able to give a birthday present to a fellow victim just shows me resilience that Boston has. So that is my hubbub for today. Renee Loth and John Carroll, thank you so much for joining me.
Have a great
weekend.
Thanks.
There's more of the show when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.